Welcome to The Gauge, a podcast brought to you by Green Gauge, the first fully integrated financial services group, bridging the traditional financial services space with the new digital innovations in crypto assets and blockchain. In this series, we gauge expert opinion on the latest tech trends and plan to bring you a measured approach to discussing key developments in the world of blockchain and digital assets. Today, Sean Kiernan, CEO of Green Gauge, meets financial services executive and digital assets legal and regulatory expert Ijeoma Okoli to talk about the Digital Economy Initiative, as well as to discuss her recent article for NYU on the genesis of a banking crisis. They also discuss the US regulatory crackdown on digital assets, the need for capital and liquidity requirements for stablecoins, and the most important things that traditional finance, or TradFi, and the crypto world can learn from one another.
So welcome to The Gauge, Ijeoma. It's a delight to have you with us.
Thank you.
I've been hearing a lot from you in the space, and it's great to have a fellow American in London on The Gauge. It'd be great to hear some of your background for our audience, and if you could specifically describe what you're doing with the Digital Economy Initiative.
So I'm a finance regulatory lawyer. I started off in New York and came to London to help companies both in Western Europe and Eastern Europe raise money in the capital markets or private markets in the US and actually also in Europe. So did a number of listings both in the US and actually on stock exchanges around Europe, including London, Ireland, and Luxembourg. So that was the initial brief that brought me over here. And ultimately, with the financial crisis, there was a lot of chaos in the markets, to say the least. And I started focusing on some of the financial regulation that was coming out of the US that had a significant effect outside the US on the banking sector, the financial services sector in Europe. And I focused on that as well as the equivalent regulations that were coming from Europe. And particularly, you know, the clashes between the two, because, of course, the regulators were doing things independently and some of them were impacting the same transactions. And, of course, in some cases, they couldn't actually comply with both. And ultimately, regulators came to some agreements eventually that actually made things a little bit easier. And that was mostly in the derivatives markets. And then I moved over to the prudential side, ultimately ending up at JP Morgan and doing some of that prudential work focused on bank recovery and resolution. But also I did a number of focused on their chief investment officer and corporate treasury, did some work in relation to LIBOR, lots of things, and ultimately ended up on the asset management side doing compliance and then developed an interest in crypto. And I studied it for a number of years before actually working and co-designing the risk management and governance framework for cryptocurrencies at JP Morgan for the group.
Which is pretty cool.
Yes, it is. But I think what's even more cool is all the stuff that's happening across the sector, whether it's from the perspective of, you know, folks in the art world who are looking at NFTs, to stablecoins, to CBDCs, to everything I think in the sector is really interesting, which is one of the reasons why I made the decision to leave and kind of just jump in completely into the sector. And one of the things I did, I was having conversations with a friend of mine, Toby Norfolk Thompson, because he was previously in the banking sector and then also made the move into crypto. So we were talking all throughout 2021. And ultimately, those conversations led us to establishing the Digital Economy Initiative, which is an independent think tank. And it brings together people from different backgrounds, different disciplines. He's a trader, I'm a lawyer, financial services. And there are people from other backgrounds. And it's to people who understand things that exist in the traditional economy, but also have a significant background or interest or understanding of the digital asset sector and can actually participate in trying to figure out common sense proposals that will actually work, things that focus on encouraging innovation, but also thinking about some of the risks, including investment protection, financial stability, and coming up with common sense proposals to mitigate that are narrowly tailored to those risks. And so, and also education is very important. So we've come across lots of people. I've come across lots of people who just don't understand the sector. And having been through all the regulation that came out after the 2008-2009 financial crisis and some of the issues that I saw, I know folks don't want a repeat of that, where laws were put in place that when they got to the regulation stage, they just didn't work. And it was too late because the regulators' hands were tied. And some, we saw some of that during the last financial crisis. So what will be ideal will be for the folks who are putting laws in place right now to understand what it is that they're creating those laws for, so that we don't get to the situation where things just don't work so far down the line that you have to find inelegant solutions to that.
I mean, I think personally what you're doing is fantastic. And having that US-UK bridge and background in legal and financial services is something that is really important. Also, this pragmatic approach. I know that the market's moving very quickly around this, and you've written a piece recently in New York University Alumni Journal, I think.
It was the law school, the Center for Corporate Compliance and Enforcement.
Yeah.
So that part, yeah.
And what's happened in the banking space.
Yes.
And it'd be great if you could just give kind of your thoughts about, obviously the US crypto-friendly banks have taken a real beating recently.
Yeah.
But not just exclusively. I was really intrigued to see particularly this thought leadership and how you framed it, which in a way for me was highly intelligible. And hopefully that translates.
So yeah, it was a question of kind of looking at, you know, I think lots of people were, this was the first major banking crisis that we've had since the financial crisis. And I think the financial crisis taught me to pay attention to everything. And so just looking at what was happening, I wanted to understand what was happening. And also there was a crypto element, you know, because people had started to blame the crypto sector for the downfall of Silvergate, SVB, and Signature. And so it was, you know, kind of blocking out the noise and looking at a fact. So looking at what they've done, their performance, I looked at their financial statements and annual reports that they filed with the SEC, which are public, then looked at some of the data. And essentially what I found, and some of this has been borne out with the reports that the Fed published about 2 weeks ago and the FDIC published also around the same time about what actually happened. It's the lack of risk management. It was management's failures that actually ultimately caused the collapse of all the banks. So I think management can't get off scot-free. But looking specifically at what maybe they didn't do or they did do, you look at all three banks, there's a high concentration of client segments. In first Silvergate and Signature, it was the crypto sector. For SVB, it was the tech sector. And so when you have that level of concentration, when there are issues with the sector in which your clients are concentrated, then, you know, you do get some of that blowback. You do suffer some of the consequences of that. And that was one of the things. And, you know, given the amount of money that these entities had, a lot of them were uninsured. So there was panic, social media panic, which, you know, the Fed acknowledged in their report that came out a couple of weeks ago that they didn't anticipate that a bank the size of SVB could actually have a systemic impact. And I think they didn't take into consideration how fast bank runs could be in the social media age. And yeah, so there were a number, I think the management is ultimately to blame for what actually happened. And actually, I think one other thing is we found out that SVB kind of removed all their interest rate hedges the prior year. And so, you know, there are questions around, you know, the reasons why they did some of the things that they did.
I mean, it's a tricky environment when the deposit base is no longer as sticky.
Yeah.
As you say, the social media effect. And that's something that's going to be with us, it seems.
Yeah.
And once the Pandora's box has opened.
Yeah.
We've seen a lot, obviously, in the digitization of payments. Mm-hmm. We spoke briefly about CBDCs before the podcast kicked off. And you've also written about stablecoins.
Yes.
I'd love to hear, kind of, given the backdrop of what's happened in the US banking system, your thoughts around stablecoins. And maybe, I know you've written another paper.
So I think the banking crisis has taught, it's a number of things. I think I've realized as a result of the crisis, I think a lot of the conversation is about the risks that the crypto sector poses to the traditional banking sector. But what we saw with SVB, if you recall, Circle had $3.3 billion that was parked in SVB. Question why, you know, but the fact was that they had $3.3 billion and the potential fall of SVB. It didn't ultimately, the regulators decided they were going to guarantee all deposits, but for a number of days, that was not the case. And the USDC, which is issued by Circle, lost its peg to the dollar and went down to about 88 cents. And then ultimately, when the news came, when the regulators decided that they were going to guarantee all deposits, it repegged back up to the dollar. So we saw the opposite, I think, essentially happened, the potential risk that, you know, the big traditional banking sector poses to the crypto sector. One would think that your deposits in a bank are relatively safe, a regulated bank are relatively safe, but not what actually ultimately happened.
Particularly in relation to stablecoins. Mm-hmm. I know you've written a paper recently about capital and liquidity requirements and some thoughts around that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
I'd love to hear if you could summarize that. We'll give the links to our readers in the description.
Sure. So it was a number of us that came together to write that paper. You know, people who have expertise in the banking sector understand liquidity and things like that. And the idea was drawing lessons from a number of things that have happened in the traditional finance sector, including the recent banking crisis, just essentially looking at where, like a stablecoin, and basically the UK is adopting a new term that you find in the financial services and markets bill called digital settlement assets. So essentially moving away from the term stablecoin and moving towards something that could encompass a larger segment of products that actually could be used for payment. Stablecoin, I think, is a misnomer because, you know, stablecoins we've seen are not really stable. So moving away from that language and maybe maybe relegating the term stablecoin to a subset of a digital settlement asset. It's not a guarantee that other jurisdictions are going to adopt that term, but we're in the UK, so we're going to, you know, use the term that is being bandied about. And so essentially what we thought of doing, it was tiering the different types of digital settlement assets. Tier one being things that are backed by, products that are backed by fiat, so the pound sterling, as well as treasuries, UK treasuries. And those would be considered things in tier one. Tier two would include things like assets like corporate debt, top tier corporate debt, or highly rated corporate debt, as well as a highly rated commercial paper. And then, you know, when you have those tiers, there's a possibility for other tiers down the line to the extent that the regulators agree that these are, you know, safe, they could be used for payment. But, you know, when you have those tiers, you have the possibility to allow for developments or new products that come into the future and the possibility of classifying them within a framework. So in relation to the top tier, the idea was to kind of restrict the amount of money that you actually put within banks because of the possibility of the risk, the counterparty risk that they pose, put a certain amount of money in banks, and then actually also have a cap on the amount that you could actually put in each bank, differing between globally systemically important institutions and non-GSIBs, as well as, you know, having a certain amount go into UK government debt. So those are some of the ideas we've come up with in terms of trying to establish a liquidity framework for stable coins, and then it will be uniform across the board for that tier one, so that essentially, potentially, they could be fungible with each other. Tier two, as I mentioned, they could include other things, and the other tiers are to be decided. But it's also the fact that we're, you know, advocating for stress tests, adequate stress tests to ensure that when people actually do go to redeem their stable coins, they actually are able to redeem their stable coins. So the whole thing is built around the potential risks that what we call stable coins right now and what the UK looks to be calling digital settlement assets, that when people actually look to redeem them, they actually have the possibility of getting their money back.
What's so interesting about that framework, obviously, again, it's very pragmatic, mm-hmm. but some of those instruments carry a yield-bearing instrument mm-hmm. behind it. Mm-hmm. And to think about a digital settlement asset having a yield-bearing instrument acting as almost a means for payment means you could hold, say, a bond or commercial paper mm-hmm. or debt mm-hmm. and pay with that commercial paper, debt mm-hmm. or bond, mm-hmm. which is kind of very different to the way that banking is currently constituted.
It is, but I think one of the things we have to realize, they exist already, right? You know, people are, you know, using it already to move money around the world. So the question, I think it's just, again, being pragmatic. What is the reality right now? How do we ensure that people are protected given what is actually already happening? So they're already being used. It's not that we're, you know, creating a completely different product. It's just essentially, given what we have right now, making it as safe as possible for people to actually use.
And maybe opening up access to if it's providing a yield, there's obviously somebody benefiting from that. Hopefully more people get access to capital.
Yeah, more people get access to capital. And there's a plus for, you know, governments because it provides additional liquidity for a government bond. So I think, you know, there are pluses to it, not just that it will be used for as a means of payment. And so one of them is exactly as you said.
Broadening the base. Speaking of broadening the base, a slightly political question around Operation Choke Point 2.0, which for our listeners is what's been mentioned in the US potentially as being an effort to restrict access to banking for the likes of crypto companies, as we've seen some of the big banks in the space fall in the US. Do you think that this is, given that you have some insights that I think some of us don't have, do you think this is something that's real?
You know, a few months ago, a lot of people were talking about Operation Choke Point. I hear a lot less about it now. Actually, probably in the last week, I don't think I've heard anybody but you mention it right now. So I don't believe so, because that means that it's coordinated across all branches of government, right? But if you look at, you only have to look at the back and forth between the SEC chair and Congress, because there have been a couple of hearings, one in particular, I think about 3 weeks ago. Gary Gensler appeared before the House Financial Services Committee, and they don't like what he's doing. So I don't think so, but I think certain things that have happened lend themselves to that narrative. For example, Signature Bank, I think one of the members of the board, you know, famous to anybody who was around during the financial crisis, Barney Frank, who's Dodd-Frank is named after. So he has a certain standing within the community. I think he did say that the regulators came after Signature because they banked crypto firms. Mm. The regulators denied that. But then, of course, we saw once Signature Bank was bought, the purchaser left the digital assets portfolio behind. So, you know, I think I don't necessarily believe that, but I think the things that have happened haven't necessarily lent themselves to completely counter that narrative, so to say.
Yeah. And the market dynamics are tricky. Mm-hmm. I know you spoke recently about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. could you tell us how you're taking some historic documents in the U.S. too?
Well, I think, you know, I was watching, I think about 4 or 5 days ago, there was another hearing. There was another crypto-related hearing in the House. And actually, it was a joint committee between the House Agricultural Committee and the House Financial Services Committee, which was interesting. There's still people talking about, in the Senate, people talking about banning crypto. But I think people are going to use it. We know that this technology is not going anywhere. People are going to use it anyway. I don't necessarily believe that is the place of government to essentially ban it. And yes, I thought about, you know, the Declaration of Independence and in particular the pursuit of happiness and how, you know, although I think one of the things I mentioned is that although that phrase is not incorporated into the actual Constitution, the courts have interpreted the fundamental rights expounded on in the Declaration of Independence into the Constitution through the cases and essentially indicating that the pursuit of happiness includes the right for people to try to earn a living. And this is one way some people are using to earn a living. We saw during the pandemic when things were shut down that some folks in the Philippines used, I think it was Axie Infinity, the game to actually earn a living. So people are actually using this technology to try to, and the crypto products that are built on top of it to actually make a living. And so, you know, I don't foresee any court case going before the Supreme Court on this particular issue anytime soon. But, you know, I don't necessarily think it's, you know, if we even come close to the government banning it, maybe it will go the way of the 18th Amendment, the prohibition on alcohol. Mm. And eventually they had to repeal that amendment because you can't really, I don't think you can really enforce it. So it's a futile exercise. And I think we should be focusing on energies and trying to make it safe.
Yes.
For people as opposed to trying to ban it.
One thing we've been discussing is the interplay between TradFi, traditional finance, and the crypto world or digital world. Mm-hmm. Two of the biggest names that have gone bust recently, FTX and Credit Suisse, I think give us learnings respectively, particularly for FTX. Mm-hmm. We've heard a lot that this isn't a crypto issue, this is a governance issue. What specifically do you think are the takeaways, not just for the crypto world, but also for TradFi?
Well, I think there's a lot that the crypto world could learn from TradFi. I think, you know, one, don't use QuickBooks for accounting. And I say that in jest. But I think, you know, governance, definitely risk management, controls, there are lots of things that I think that the crypto sector could learn from the traditional financial services sector, because the traditional financial services sector has been around for a very long time. They've had their own scandals. And so regulation has been put in place after every issue arises to mitigate the risk of that essentially happening again. So I think there are things that we can draw from the traditional financial sector and put it into the entities that are most active, the entities people rely on in the crypto sector, the conflicts of interest, mitigating conflicts of interest within an entity or group of entities. So those are some of the things that the crypto sector could take from the traditional finance sector. In terms of what the traditional financial sector can take from the crypto sector, I think they're doing some of that already, because banks are exploring using blockchain, right? We've come across, I think there have been probably about three that I know of, I think the first being in Australia, the second being in Europe, where in the capital markets, the sector that I originally spent a lot of years of my career in, using blockchain to clear trades. So it goes from essentially a T+5 timeline for closing, T+3, T+5, depending on where you are, to T+0, basically real time. So, there's stuff that the traditional financial sector can take from the crypto sector and utilize it to better serve their clients and actually, reduce risks themselves. Yeah, those are some of the things that I think that they could possibly get from each other.
Yeah, thank you.
But the crypto sector is still very immature, and I think it has a lot of growing to do.
You're growing in. Mm-hmm. I think one thing I've been saying a lot is that it's no longer just the technology. It's getting people around the table, talking through how we can improve things. And I think what you're doing at the Digital Economy Initiative is super important too.
Thank you.
To help with that. So an honor to have you with us, Ijoma. Thank you very much.
Thank you.